Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we're focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey everybody, welcome back to Drive On. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and today my guest is Dr. Michael Barnes. Dr. Barnes is an expert in addiction counseling, trauma-integrated treatment, and family therapy. And with over 40 years of experience in the field, he has dedicated his career to understanding and addressing the complex interplay between addiction, trauma, and family dynamics. As a founder and director of the Michael Barnes Family Institute and chief clinical officer at the Foundry Treatment Center, he's going to bring a wealth of knowledge and expertise to our discussion today. And quite frankly, I'm not sure where you find the time with all that other stuff you have going on, but I want to welcome you to the show. Mike, I'm glad to have you here.
Yeah, it's great to be here. I worked with Vietnam veterans and their families when I was in my doctoral program. And when I had the opportunity to come on this podcast, I was thrilled to be able to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm always happy to bring in folks that have different perspectives, different backgrounds and things like that. I like having folks with a military background because obviously the folks who listen to this show tend to relate more to the folks with a military background, but we're not all, not all military experiences necessarily have to be, 100% military focused. We can talk to other people outside of the military and learn from their experiences and their, maybe treatment options and other things that they might do, because there's a lot of crossover and similarities between some of the things that people experience in civilian life and things that people experience in the military. And, there's traumatic experiences and traumatic events that occur in civilian life too. And there are folks who are, outside the military world that can bring in good perspectives. And that's, why I like having folks like you. And obviously you've worked with the Vietnam, era, kind of getting your perspective and hear what you have to say about, this type of subject. So
sure.
Let's just jump in and talk about, could you shed some light on this concept of secondary trauma and its impact on family members and caregivers of the individuals who have experienced trauma. So we're talking mm-hmm. about what happens to the family members of the person who is affected, particularly within the context of, mental health disorders and these other traumatic events that might occur.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So, when we think about post-traumatic stress disorder, an event happens, person experiences it, they have symptoms, and it's an event that is so overwhelming to our normal defense system that it sort of hijacks the way our brain manages threat. And so where the primary trauma survivor has symptoms related to an event, that their family members who love them dearly have symptoms associated with their loved one's symptoms. And so the secondary trauma is actually family members being traumatized by the changes that the primary trauma survivor makes biologically, psychologically, and socially, but also in how the interactions change and the distance begins to grow and uncertainty. And so secondary trauma, individuals who have it have the exact same symptoms of primary post-traumatic stress disorder. They're just a little different and they're more geared towards the loved one who's been traumatized.
It's interesting because you don't typically think about this as, something that could occur when dealing with a traumatic event, someone who's experienced this traumatic event. You don't mm-hmm. always think about those secondary and other effects that may end up occurring. But we oftentimes see folks coming back from a deployment, for example, where there's plenty of opportunities to experience traumatic events. And they come back home and then their marriages fall apart and their relationships fall apart and things are, you always hear it, it's just not the same as it was before. Well, okay, well, why isn't it the same? You know, obviously the person who went overseas, they changed to, you know, due to the trauma that they experienced. But in a way it's also traumatic for the family members to be sitting at home worrying about their loved ones overseas, right? That in a way that's a sort of trauma that they're dealing with that maybe doesn't get recognized very often. But also when that loved one comes back home and they see how much they've changed and all these things, they tend to change too, like you were just saying. And so it's no wonder that we have all these problems that we end up having, right? I mean, it's quite a bit to go through.
Well, and if you think about while the individual is deployed, their partner is basically taking on all the roles of parenting and all of these things, and they get good at it. And then their loved one comes home, and if their loved one is not the same in many ways, then it does add a lot of tension to the relationship in that, I know you want to come home and be a part of this leadership of this family again, but I had it like a fine-tuned machine. Now it makes it a lot harder. And I always explain it as if you worked with someone for a long time and you knew what they were going to do before they did it, and they knew what you were going to do, that you could go about your business, and it made work so much simpler. And then that person quits and you get a new person who doesn't know the policies and procedures and doesn't know the day-to-day routines. And then it just complicates everything and makes everything a lot harder. And so I think a lot of time when people come home, there is a conflict about the day-to-day. I'll tell you an interesting story. I was doing a research project with families of individuals who had mental health issues and addiction and trauma. And I asked them, what's the most difficult trauma that you have with this? And what they told me wasn't really a trauma at all. It was a grief response. And the idea, and they said, it's the shattering of dreams, the shattering of expectations, and you know, and I hear families say it all the time, it's not what I thought I was signing up for. And it's just so different. And
that's right.
And there's so much conflict and so much uncertainty and fear that that's, I think for many of these families, that's the foundation, that it's they desperately want everything to go back to the way it was before. And that isn't necessarily going to happen.
Right. It's sort of mourning the loss of what was, you know, the good thing, quote unquote, good thing that you had going before whatever that traumatic event was, or events, plural, you know, depending on what the situation is. You might have had a good thing going. And then now you come back to a situation where it's changed and it's different. And how do you cope with that? How do you deal with that? It's not always easy to do that, right? And particularly for
anytime there's
go ahead.
I was going to say, anytime there's change, it requires the establishment of new kind of stable patterns. Meaning, now we have to have new plans on how we're going to make this change work. And the reason that I titled my book, When the Solution Becomes the Problem, is because what happens is families begin to make these shifts to be able to live with the uncertainty that actually makes it harder for the individual to actually resolve their trauma symptoms. And so it's a solution to make things doable, but it's often a solution that creates far more problems down the road for the family and for the members of the family.
Yeah, and when you create these kind of unforeseen problems, it it has that trickle down effect where maybe, you know, initially it's just affecting maybe the spouse, but then maybe it's also affects the spouse, and then it affects the children. And that, you know, it kind of has that, we're talking about like a secondary effect, but maybe even a tertiary, and, you know, even go down the line, you know, where maybe it affects, you know, the spouse's career, affects the kids in school and people around them, the relationships that they maybe had. It can kind of expand out, you know, rather quickly if you don't kind of nip this in the bud, you know, before it gets a little bit out of control. So in your experience, what are some common maybe signs or symptoms of this secondary trauma that maybe family members might be exhibiting, and how do you see it in their daily lives and in the relationships that they're going through their daily lives? How do you see that affecting them, you know, in a real world sense?
Well, I think oftentimes if we kind of think about, you know, like a mobile over a baby's crib, like, and if you touch one, it all moves, and it's always trying to find homeostasis. It's always trying to find its balance. And that when a loved one is traumatized, and it could be any, like our son was hit by a car. I have a son who's 37 years old, and he was hit by a car when he was 5, and he was never supposed to live. He was supposed to, his injuries were so severe. And I was studying secondary trauma at the time, and I thought, wow, that's pretty, I used to joke with him, he didn't need to get hit by a car to give me a dissertation topic. I could have figured that out by myself. But there are so many subtle changes. There are big changes because there are, you know, circumstances that you have to deal with. But there are lots of subtle changes in terms of anxiety and hypervigilance, needing to feel in control. And so what we will often see is family members or family leaders beginning to control all of the people around in the family to say, you know, we need to make sure that we're doing what we need to do in order for mom to be okay or dad to be okay or the kid to be okay. And so we begin to see changes in the rules of communicating. You know, let's not talk about those things. Let's not, try to manage our behavior so that, you know, he or she gets really angry or really what we call dysregulated when there's a lot of noise in the house and there's a lot going on. And so let's make this as safe as possible so that we can, you know, be here to love and support each other. Well, that, what message that tends to send, and one of the things that we realized in research that I had done at Florida State University when I was there, was the idea that when there is a traumatized individual, everyone else in the family seems to assume that their needs are less important than the traumatized person's needs. Which, as long as that's a short-term process, but you know, we can defer gratification of those things. Sure. But if I'm a kid, and I'm never allowed to run through the house and you know, be funny or you know, how do kids learn how to feel their feelings? They learn how to feel them by experiencing them and then having adults kind of work with them and help regulate them. Yeah. And so if kids are told, you know, you need to behave all the time, because it just makes matters worse, then kids begin to, you know, they begin to question, well, maybe I'm the problem. And so there are a lot of things that we see with kids that, you know, I think I'm trying to think of like the best way to say it. When kids have adults in their life that they know are the primary support for them, and that the primary support systems are always upset or controlling to try to keep everything safe, that kids don't really have the little kids don't have the ability to say, well, you know, I just need to defer gratification of my needs for a while and then I'll be fine. Right. And what they say is, these are the people that are supposed to be taking care of me. And so I need to be whatever they need me to be so that I can be loved and cared for. Mm-hmm. And ultimately what we found in our research was that what kids will say is eventually, you know, being me is dangerous. I need to be what they need me to be. And therefore there's this lack of a self-esteem or this sense of being me is always gets me in trouble. So I need to be something other than me. And so this is why as an addiction counselor, I often see these 20-year-old, 25-year-olds who just have no idea who they are. And then I'll ask, so what kind of trauma happened in your life and in your family? And they'll say, oh, you know, nothing that I'm aware of. But then the mom will say, well, you know, one mom told me that she had 3 miscarriages before he was born and that she treated him like nitroglycerin, you know, like I don't want him to be the next one to get injured. So, and we did that with our son a lot, this idea of we didn't want him to grow up because, you know, we wanted to bubble wrap him, put bubble wrap around him in case something else would happen, not because of him, but because it was so frightening for us as parents. And so I think those are things that we have to kind of keep in mind that, you know, we call addiction treatment rehabilitation, but in many cases it's habilitation. It's really teaching young people who they are and that they have a right to have needs and they have a right to get their needs met. And so often that when there is trauma in a home, that oftentimes the person who is the primary survivor, they're everyone's so worried about their needs that other people's needs don't get met. So that's one thing that we begin to see. The other thing is that the longer the family members' autonomic nervous system stay on red alert, like that we need to be cautious, that they begin to focus more on survival than they do on other things. Mm-hmm. And so this is when you might see enabling happening where we're not going to hold someone responsible for their behavior because we don't want them to get upset and we don't want anything bad to happen. So we're going to allow things to sort of happen and we're just going to have to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and so often it comes, you know, in addiction, we talk about powerlessness and the idea of it's an illness. You can't just will it away. And that family members also have to come to terms with a bit of powerlessness. And that if they could make this all go away, they would. But they can't. It's a chronic, progressive, you know, illness that it functions better when the whole family begins to say, you know, I think we all have trauma. And I always know I'm getting somewhere when, you know, someone in the family says, you know, I think I'm just as traumatized. And it's like, oh, okay. Well, now we're getting somewhere. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. It's interesting perspectives on this. Cause it's, you know, but before we, you know, started chatting, you know, before this episode, really secondary trauma was not something that really in my head was something that ever existed. Mm-hmm. now that I think about it, it makes a lot of sense because of all the things that we just talked about. You know, having kids especially not understand that there's a temporary time maybe that dad's not going to want to be around loud noises. And so let's not run around the house and slamming doors and, you know, being a kid, basically. Let's put that off for just a bit because dad kind of has a problem with that. Let's try to, you know, kind of just help dad out and everything. And the way I think of it is like, if somebody like in your son's case, somebody got hit by a car, right then, mm-hmm. no other needs are as important as the needs of that person who just got hit by a car. Like you're going to drop everything It's like, well, I'm hungry. I need to go get food. Well, no, you don't. Not right now. You need to go help that person, right? That's the immediate need. I'm cold. I need to go get my jacket. No, you need to go help that person, right? That's the immediate need. But to a little kid, that is something they just probably don't understand. Mm-hmm. Like that right now is not the time for me to be me. Right now I need to be something a little bit different for mom, for dad, for whoever, so that they can get the help that they need and they can heal without, having more trauma added onto it or more things triggering that traumatic event. That's a really hard concept for a little kid to grasp, and depending on the age, probably impossible to grasp. And so that's where you get that, what you're just talking about, where they kind of think, well, maybe I'm the problem or something's wrong with me. Maybe I'm the one causing dad to get mad. I'm the one who's, causing mom to lose it when I slam that door or whatever, and that's not true at all. And I think the reason why I wanted to have you on the show is because I think there's a lot of folks out there who might be listening to this who maybe have experienced something like this in their own families, mm-hmm. and maybe didn't quite realize what was going on and why is my kid acting, like walking on eggshells around me, or, why is my kid, maybe starting to have problems as they get a little bit older with maybe drugs, sure. or alcohol or something else. Why is this happening? And I don't want to say, hey, it's because of you, right? I don't want to say that. I want to say that it's because they just don't know who they are, right? And they need to be okay with being themselves, and they need help now to understand who they are. And all of these experiences shape who we are. So you can't just take that away and be like, hey, pretend this never happened. Just go back to the way you were when you were, 4 years old or whatever the time period was. You can't just do that, but you can help them kind of be okay with who they are and not feel like they have to walk on eggshells around you.
I think one of the primary factors. But I'd like to hear from you. Yeah, you're right on target with this. And it's like one of the big factors is one of the rule changes that happens of not wanting to upset anyone or to keep everything as safe as possible is that we don't talk about it.
Yeah.
And what a kid needs might be, let's talk about it. Let's really talk about why do I get upset when that happens? Well, there was a lot of... So if we remember how trauma symptoms and how trauma memories are processed, there isn't a story that's going on in our head when it's happening. All we're remembering are the sensory information that's happening while the trauma is happening. Hmm. And so if I go into a village and there are kids yelling and screaming and running and there's a firefight or there's something going on, and then I'm at home and my son brings three of his friends in the house and they're running through the house yelling and laughing. And to me, it sounds like screaming. That's going to bring everything back to me.
Yeah.
And that's how, Bessel van der Kolk, who's a very famous neuroscientist, says that trauma isn't going to come back to you as a memory. It's going to come back to you as a reaction because something triggers that reaction. And that's why parents get angry, and that's why the traumatized individual maybe withdraws, because something's happening around them that is reminding them of that. And I think if one of the things is people talk about it and to say, mm-hmm. It's not about you. This is just one of the things. This is one of the struggles that I have. And but that means breaking the rule of don't talk about it. That means you have to talk about it.
That's right. And sometimes it's hard to talk about it, especially in an age appropriate way, when you might have somebody who's, really young, like a child, and you may not want to get into the gory details of all the things that happen, but you could probably work with them and talk to them in an age appropriate way, and Everybody's sure. going to be a little bit different. You know, certain kids are much more mature too than others. So I don't want to say, a 5-year-old, you have to talk to them this way because, you know, a 5-year-old might have a higher, maturity level than their peers. And so you might be able to talk to them with a little bit more, more detail than you might somebody else. So you, I guess, put it this way, you're going to know your kid a little bit better than, anybody else would. So kind of use your own judgment there. But it's not even just kids, it's also, your significant others or other folks that you have any sort of relationship with, friends and coworkers and people like that. Hey, look, this is something that happened to me. And this is what happens when this thing happens. It triggers this response in me. I could use your help in, kind of minimizing that and maybe giving me a heads up before you bring your friends over and have them yelling and screaming, going through the house, so it's not just a shock to the system. Something along those lines, I would imagine is the right way to go. Right. Is that kind of what Absolutely. You would suggest?
Yeah, I'm not talking about going into the trauma story at all. I'm just saying, loud noises just, my nervous system, it just makes me really anxious. And it's been my experience in working with veterans is that they're so aware of not wanting to traumatize the people that they love that sometimes they'll avoid going to therapy with family, because they think that the therapist is going to have them tell this big trauma story. And I clearly that is not what I, as a therapist, my thing would be, we're going to talk about symptoms. We're going to talk about what's going on in the house, not what caused it. That's between you and, whomever, and again, with our son, we knew what caused it for him. And my wife was, it's interesting. My wife was standing maybe 10 yards from him when he got hit. And so he got hit. She witnessed it, but I did not witness it. I was at school. And so our experience of the trauma is really different. And I think that's the other part of this, is that when you have different family members, some of whom were closer in proximity to what was going on, and others, that not everyone in the house is going to have the same understanding of what the problem is.
Right. Right. And the other thing too, is even if you were there and you did witness it happen, maybe you're standing right next to your wife and you saw it happening in real time. The two of you still could have completely different responses to the same event, right?
Well, the research on eyewitness testimony tells you a lot about that, that four people standing on four corners watching the same automobile accident, you would think their stories would be pretty consistent. Yeah. And they're not consistent. They're really, right. really different. And so not getting into, and so often therapists will say, we need to get to the truth of this. Or the family says that. And it's like, whose truth? Like your truth, their truth? Like the idea that everyone does have their own kind of truth. And one of the other things I found in my research was that perception is way more important than reality.
Yeah.
Meaning my view of what I think is going on has in many cases very little to do with what's actually happening. Yeah. And so particularly the more anxious I get, the more rigid my beliefs become, and I become less solution oriented and more problem focused. And I think that's a big part of the therapy process, is to help people move back into more of a solution oriented view than a problem oriented view.
Yeah, for sure. And when you're talking about the, four people on four different corners watching the same accident and having totally different description of what happened. So my brother was killed in Afghanistan, and I've read the reports, the kind of sworn statements from all the people who are on the ground, all the soldiers who are there, and their description of what happened and all those events. And there's probably 20-25 descriptions, and very few of them had, lined up details of everything that happened. Some people saw at a different point in time, and they didn't see the initial thing, or they didn't, you know, see everything that happened, and or their point of view, like they thought maybe the shot came from a different place than someone else. And it was really hard to line up the story and say, okay, what actually happened? Right. And as I was reading it, I realized just how much, like what you just said, perception, for each one of these people, their perception of what happened, has got to be, more important in their own mind, in their own, mental state than what actually happened, the reality of what actually happened. And, you know, we may never know exactly the reality of every single detail, and that's fine. What we know is what happened, as far as their perception goes, and that's what they're carrying with them to this day, right?
Well, and think about it. I mean, we are by nature sort of driven to try to solve our problems based on how we understand them. And so therapy is about, I always say, you know, new insights create new solutions, and new solutions create new behaviors, and new behaviors create new relationships, and new relationships create family healing. And so the idea of, like, I think there's two different kinds of clinical intervention for families. One is more of a coaching philosophy, which is a lot of teaching and a lot of support and helping them to begin to really see things differently. And the other really is a therapy component that's looking at symptoms and new ways of interacting and really helping them begin to make those changes. And I think both are absolutely critical to help families, but if we can create new ideas or begin to put a little crack in the belief system of what if it didn't happen exactly that way? And it's like, or what if this is way more complicated than you're making it? Like, maybe there's more to this. And that opens the door to, well, if there's more to it, maybe there are other solutions that I can find to help our family heal. That's the beginning in my mind of the process, is where everyone begins to question, you know, this is what I remember, but it's not necessarily what it all is.
Right. And so I want to talk about your book. I don't think I mentioned that earlier, and I apologize for that. But so your book, When the Solution Becomes the Problem, is the title of the book. You discuss the concept of the family resilience and the change process and healing from the trauma. Can you talk about this a little bit? You started talking a little bit about this here, but can you talk about how they relate to supporting the families affected by addiction or trauma or you know, things along those lines?
Yeah, back in the late 1980s, I think it was 89, my mentor, a guy by the name of Charles Figley, who was a Vietnam vet, who is now a renowned trauma researcher and scholar, published an article that said, you know, family resilience is that everyone in the family realizes that we're in this together, not we, that this is, so it's like in therapy, we call the person with the trauma the identified patient. Because that's how everyone looks at them. They look at him like, well, if he would just get better, then we could go back to normal. Well, that's not true at all. That there's a new normal that's evolving from the day he gets home or the day she, you know, comes back from, you know, whatever surgery she just had or the kid getting hit by the car, that a new normal is happening with us trying to figure out how to live with it. And so the first step in resiliency for families is to recognize, you know, we've all been traumatized. And if we keep looking, I was teaching a class last night at the University of Colorado, and we were using that mobile analogy. And I said, as long as the client is the one in the middle of the mobile, they're the only one that doesn't move. Everyone else is changing and everyone else is moving. And that person stays stuck in the middle and as the focus. And we got to take that person out of that role and into well, since we've all been traumatized, how do we begin to manage it? And one of the other things is resilient families really do think in terms of solutions rather than always thinking about the problem. And the idea of, since there's no one that's the identified patient and we're all part of the healing process, that we're going to be really gentle as much as we can with each other. We're going to give each other the opportunity to have a bad day without resentment or without frustration. Family resilience allows each member of the family to have their own support systems. Like the kids get to have kid friends, and with a lot of issues like addiction, the family, and if there's a lot of pretty significant trauma symptoms, families tend to put a really rigid boundary around the family. And they do that because they're still trying to figure out what to do and how to help. And information coming in from outside just confuses things. And, you know, the kids getting information from the outside. So a lot of times that's some of the trauma for kids, is that they're not able to hang out with their friends the way they want to. They're not able to, you know, go to events at the school the way they want to. And so, you know, we want to make sure that those boundaries stay open so that everyone can get help. Social support is the number one thing. And actually, the research says that social support's the number one mitigating factor for trauma. And that rather than circling the wagons and like keeping everything blocked off, that the more they can open the wagons and let each person in the family have their own support system, that's really helpful. Getting rid of any kind of drinking or drugging or any kind of dangerous behavior that makes it harder for the family to heal is another one of those factors. And so we know that Paul Early, who's a fellow in the American Society of Addiction Medicine, wrote a really, really good book that says there are three reasons that people become addicted. One is genetics or epigenetics. The environment that they live in turns genes on or turns genes off. The second is self-medication of trauma and mental health issues. And the third is being in an environment where heavy use of drugs and alcohol is the norm. And so we know when at the Foundry, where I was the chief clinical officer, actually until 2 weeks ago, where I'm now a senior, I have a new title, senior clinical fellow or something, or senior clinical consultant or something like that. But the idea is that we know that 30 to 35% of our clients have post-traumatic stress disorder. Like we do testing, we know that. And we know another 30 to 35% have what we call developmental trauma. And developmental trauma is those kids that don't get their needs met when they're little, don't go through the developmental stages the way they are healthiest when they do. And so that's when they begin to question themselves. And so about 70% of our clients have trauma. And so you can't just treat addiction, you have to treat both. But by its very nature, addiction treatment is a triggering event for most traumatized individuals, because we have them talking about the things that happened because of their addiction and the people who have gotten hurt and the consequences. And so often that fear response or defensive response of, I don't want to talk about those things, when the therapist is saying, you know, it's really important that we talk about those things, because we have to, you know, there are kind of, in my mind, there are three stages to treating trauma. And the first one is safety. And safety is teaching folks how to manage their autonomic nervous system, how to stay calm, what we call regulating, how to regulate themselves, and how to stay sober and how to not engage in risky behavior or, self-injurious behaviors, things like that. And then they can start talking about the trauma story. Once they can have the ability to be focused on the trauma story without re-traumatizing, then they can talk about it. And so lot of times clients will say, well, when are we going to start working on the trauma? And it's like, you have been working on the trauma since you got here. We're just not talking about the event. We're helping you be ready to talk about the event. Right. And so all family members need, and like if I was doing family therapy with a family, I would be doing some coaching as well as some therapy and really making sure that they would learn why mindfulness is so important or why going for a long walk is so important. And so, I think those are really important to for each member of the family, or they're not going to be able to participate in therapy.
Right. I think it does. I think that makes sense. I think the way I think of it is when you have somebody who is addicted, you know, drugs, alcohol, you know, whatever, the pick your poison, they're using that to kind of cover up the master their feelings that they may be going through, right? Temporarily might make you feel good to have that drug or the alcohol or whatever. It might kind of serve as a distraction, but you're never actually addressing the core of what happened. Why do you need to feel this, get this temporary high, this temporary, you know, happy feeling or whatever? Why do you need that break from reality? What's caused that? And so, like you were saying, being able to have that conversation and talk about it, sometimes that might be the first time that they're actually speaking about these things, right? Is that kind of where you're going with that?
Absolutely. And then the family programming, our family program is every bit as trauma integrated as our addiction treatment program, meaning the partner. So we only treat men at our treatment center, so I'll always say they're partners. They have to learn the exact same thing. Yeah. They're very hypervigilant. They're very controlling. They're trying to keep all the balls in the air for the kids and all of these other things. And so to just say, well, here's your loved one and this is what they need, is not going to, that's a solution that's going to become the next huge problem. If we don't teach the family members, there's a parallel process here. And that both are going to need to go into this healing process in order for the family to truly heal.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And it's not done in an accusatory way. It's really looking at chronic disease management from a medical perspective. And when someone has a chronic disease, like a mental health issue or, you know, a multiple sclerosis or something, you know, the family has to begin to realize that we're all going to be living with this for a really long time. And so we all have to be in healing mode to create the new normal that actually will become a solution that is a solution.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that is an important concept too, that new normal. I know after my brother was killed, it was something that people had said, there's going to be this new normal. And I started to hate that phrase because it's like, well, none of this is normal. I don't want to get used to this. This isn't something I want to just be okay with, but eventually you kind of have to realize that you're either going to be okay with it or you're not. It doesn't matter. It's not going to change your reality of what the situation is. And so you kind of have to just give in and accept the fact that, yeah, this is going to be the new normal, despite how abnormal the situation may seem. This is life, and you're going to have to deal with whatever it is that had happened. And so, yeah, you know, I changed, my family changed, the folks that were around us, we all changed because now there's this person who used to be a part of our lives who isn't. That's a huge change. But how do you just accept that and go on with life, as if everything is normal, and that I would imagine might vary from person to person. Like how do you pick up the pieces and move on? But I think for everybody, you have to figure that out. You have to figure out what that way is for you to move on and continue. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think the reality is that we're going to create a new normal. Like the new normal that my wife and I created was being overly protective.
Yeah.
Until our son at age 7 said, "What do you think I'm going to do? Get hit by another car?" It was an accident. And we looked at each other and like, he's the healthiest person in this house. Like, we're going to really impair this kid if we don't start really looking at how are we doing this. And I'll always remember the look on his face that day and how he was aghast at our behavior. Like he couldn't get over how we had changed. And so I would rather the new normal come from like conversations about difficult things and the reality of what our life is going to look like going forward than the reality that evolves out of not talking about it and the silence. And I think that's where the solution becomes the problem. Like there are so many examples where if we just choose to avoid it, which is, isn't that one of the primary symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder? Avoidance of people and places that remind us of the event.
Yep.
And then being agitated when, you know, we're faced with those things. And so I always tell my staff that, you know, if I'm a client and I come to the foundry and I get to use the same defenses that I used before, then I'm probably not going to get better because it's going to be more of the same. So we have to be really, really careful to make sure that they learn new things and that they talk about them in that way. And so,
right.
You know, I think therapy is often seen as being really daunting, and it can be, but it also can be really affirming.
Yeah, it can be. And, you know, I think that's been my experience through the therapy that I've gone through. At times it was very daunting, quite frankly, you know, in the very beginning, it was downright scary. Like, I got to talk about this stuff. I don't want to talk about this. This is terrible. It was not the type of thing that I really wanted to talk about, but like you were saying, that was part of the problem, was I just wasn't talking about it. I wasn't expressing the emotions that I was having. I wasn't telling the people around me what was going on, and why I, you know, had the problems that I was having. And, you know, so sometimes you just gotta take that leap of faith and say, let's just do this and let's talk about it. And things will get better. Trust the process. And, things will get better. It's like, in the military, we do this training with our gas masks, and we go into a building that has all this like tear gas billowing inside of the building, to the point where your eye, if you take your mask off, your eyes are watering, your nose is running, you're coughing, and it's a miserable experience. I don't wish that on anybody. It's funny to you know, watch other people go through it, but when you're in the middle of it, it's like, oh my God, this sucks. But you learn to trust the equipment that you have. You learn that the mass that you have works, and it keeps that gas out, and it filters all that kind of stuff out. And you learn to trust it, as miserable as it might be to go through that process, to know, okay, this is how bad it is. But you put that mask on and you clear it out the right way, and it works. And you start to trust the equipment, and you know that equipment is going to work when you need it to. And this is how well it'll work. I think it's the same kind of thing. You kind of have to just go through that suck for a little bit and trust the process and know that it'll work if you let it, You know, if you give it the time, if you give it the full attention to it, and you, you know, cut out the drinking and the drugs and the everything else, and you go in with a clear mind, and you're really focused on this, it'll work. But you have to let it work. That's the point, right?
Yeah, it is. And I think one of the things we also have to remember is that, you know, when the brain begins to change or makes the change after being traumatized, one of the common reactions is not knowing the difference between being safe and feeling safe. Mm. And that they never feel safe. And so the idea of jumping off that huge high diving board that we're talking about into change really challenges that, you know, that belief that I don't feel safe, so therefore I am not safe. And I went to a training by a psychiatrist, and I think he was in Houston, and he said that's the biggest myth in the United States, is that if I don't feel safe, that I'm not safe. When the reality is, that's a trauma response. That's not necessarily that you're not very safe. And so, and we were talking about this in class last night, the idea of, you know, if we just think of all of the factors and give people the benefit of the doubt in that therapy process, I say to my staff, and like, tell me again why we're upset with a traumatized client acting like a traumatized client. Like, we know this is what this client is going to struggle with. And it is harder. It is, you know, it's hard to watch someone really struggle. But the idea is they need to, like, that's part of the process is, and so we need to support them to jump, you know, take the big. Don't try to keep them on the diving board because you're afraid that they're going to get hurt. No, that's not helping them.
Yeah. And if you're going to use the diving board example, could you imagine, you know, Olympic divers who, you know, if you ever watched it, and they do these magnificent flips and jumps and twists and everything like that, and they land in the water, you barely even notice the water move because they just go in with such precision with that. Yeah. Could you imagine if, you know, their mother or their father or someone was just so afraid that of them getting hurt that they just didn't let them take that leap, that first jump into the pool, because no one's going to be that perfect day one, right? But it takes time and time and time, and eventually they get to this point where they're these phenomenal, divers. If someone was just so afraid to let them even take that first step, then they would have been held back. Or if they were that afraid themselves, they would have been held back, and they never would have realized the full potential that they could have achieved. And so sometimes you got to do something even though you're scared. And I think that's really kind of, in my book anyways, the definition of courage, is doing something that you're afraid of doing, even though you're afraid of doing it, you know, just doing it anyways, and being a bit courageous. And I think everybody who served in the military can understand the concept anyways, whether they've been there and experienced situations where they needed to face fear, they probably can understand it, right? And I think that's what we need to do, is just be like, hey, I got to do this. I'm so afraid to do this, but I know that this is what's going to help. I just got to do it. Right.
Yeah. Two guys from Yale did a study years ago, and they studied prisoners of war in Vietnam, and they were going to do a trauma study. And they realized that there were a significant number of people that you would have assumed had PTSD from years in confinement in those little bamboo boxes and things, but that they found that they didn't have it. They were really, you know, they were judges and they were, you know, legislators, and they were really successful. So they decided to study them rather than the PTSD. And that's where they wrote a book called Resilience. And they went on to study special forces and all kinds of different things. But one of the things that they found was optimism is a key resiliency factor, that the belief that I don't know what's going to happen, but I believe I can live through it. I'm going to be okay. And that fear is normal, but that it doesn't control them. And I think about when I was a kid, we had a local swimming pool with a high dive, and how many kids climbed up there and then would climb down the ladder because they got afraid.
Yeah.
And they would be embarrassed, and all the other kids would be like, dude, just go up there and jump off the thing. And once you do it, you'll realize it's safe. But that so often when people say I'm going to make these changes, and then it just is so terrifying that it's, you know, it makes sense on some level to say, I'm just not going to do that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of scary things that are out there that I'm not raising my hand and volunteering to doing. I'm not going to go, wrestle a bear. Like that's scary. And that's quite frankly, it's stupid. Like I just wouldn't do it. But there's different, there's like a wrestling a bear where, yeah, it's scary, and it's scary for a reason, and it has really no sense, no purpose of doing it. Like, there's no benefit to doing it, so why do it, right? But then there's that trade-off, right? There's no upside to me going out and wrestling a bear, so I'm not going to do it. That would just be the most ridiculous thing if I did. Right, exactly. So, but there is an upside to opening up and talking and doing, trusting the process of the therapy and actually truly trusting it and letting it work to help you get to a better place, because there is a benefit to that. And as scary as it might be for some people, again, there's a benefit. And so there's that risk reward trade-off. It feels like it's a high risk thing because it is scary, but it's really, quite frankly, a low risk, but a pretty high reward. If you go through it and it's working, effectively with you. So for sure, I think, everything that you're saying is definitely spot on. And I think for the folks out there who have experienced this sort of secondary trauma, whether that they're the ones who experience it themselves, or maybe their families or somebody else has experienced it from their trauma that they've gone through. I think the biggest takeaway from this whole conversation is to talk about the experience, or not necessarily the experience, but just open up and talk about what's going on with you. And that will kind of help get you in that right direction. But without being able to open up and talk, you're going to be stuck, and it's going to be pretty difficult to move on from there.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And I think the more educated people, like our program for the families, the first phase is a coaching phase. It's like, this is what addiction is. This is what trauma is. Do you relate to any of these symptoms? Oh, by the way, this is what family trauma is. And then it's like, oh, wow. Like I did a study where I talked to 260 family members, and I asked them a bunch of questions, but one for this purpose was, is living with an actively using addicted family member traumatizing? And 75% said that it is extremely traumatizing.
Oh, wow.
And 4% said that it was traumatizing. So only 5% said, I don't know what you're talking about. And so that idea of families really want to learn about their loved one's trauma so that they can better adjust to it. And then so often when they realize, wow, I have it too. And it really opens the door then to family healing. And education is key. new solutions, you know, new options. I asked a doctoral class I was teaching once, is it possible to change the past? And every single one of them said no. I said, I disagree completely. And they said, well, how do you change the past? I said, well, you don't change what happened, but you can change your understanding of what happened and change your reaction to it. And I used the example of growing up in a family with addiction. I didn't understand what was going on. I just assumed it was just a really bad situation. Until then, as an adult, I looked at it and I thought, no wonder they acted the way they did, given what they have been through. And it changed my anger and my resentment to empathy. And so once that happens, boy, the new solutions are all over the place.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the understanding of it and even putting a name to it, because, you know, especially as a young kid, you may not even know really what trauma is, but finally understanding what's going on or addiction, or, you know, you may not understand what it is, but it just putting a name all of a sudden maybe makes it a little less scary than what it had been, or gives you a little more clarity to help you understand, you know, what it is that's going on. You know, so.
Can I just say one other thing? I don't in any way want to paint the behaviors and the coping strategies of families as being anything other than loving, because they are loving. It is the attempt to keep everyone safe and to keep everyone alive and to keep everyone kind of moving in the right direction, when in reality, we sometimes don't realize that it's because we've been traumatized that we protect people, like with our son. And so that's why that educational piece of, oh, so this is normal to do this. Oh yeah, it's normal to do this.
Absolutely. For the folks who might be listening who are interested in the type of work that you do, and maybe finding out a little bit more about, you know, like secondary trauma, addiction, and other trauma type treatments, where can they go to find out more information about the work that you do, and where they can maybe reach out and get some help?
Yeah, my website is drmikebarnes.com, and it has a lot of stuff on there. There's some videos, and if anyone sends me an email, I will send them maybe some tools that they could use to maybe help with this process. I could send them my YouTube channel link so they can go in and watch videos of secondary trauma and some of the things we're talking about today. They can get my book on my website if they're interested in that. And the book is really a kind of broken into two halves. One is, this is what trauma and addiction are. And the other half is, this is what resiliency and healing look like. And this is what the questions families need to ask. And so, they can send me an email at, probably the easiest email is mike@ Barnes, BARNESED, which stands for education, and consulting.com. I'm happy to answer questions. I'm happy to make recommendations to people. This is my passion. I have the Michael Barnes Family Institute now. This is my primary job and my passion, and that is creating programming for families who have a loved one with addiction or trauma, and we're piloting it in mental health programs as well as addiction programs.
Excellent.
To help with both. So.
Well, I will have links to all of that in the show notes for the listeners who are interested. So they will be able to reach out and find out more information, get a copy of your book, and, hopefully get the help that they need or ask the questions at least to kind of point them in the right direction and get the ball rolling with that. Because I think, it's important to, get the help and reach out, and, as scary as it may be, you've done things that are even scarier than this. Trust me. I've been through both ends. I've gone through traumatic experiences myself. I've gone through therapy. I've gone through all of it. Trust me. You've gone through worse than therapy. It's not as scary as it sounds. So definitely reach out, get the help that you need and get the ball rolling on that. So before we wrap up this episode, I like to add a little bit of humor, especially on episodes where maybe the subject's a little bit dark and a little bit heavy and things like that, just to add a little levity to the conversation. And sometimes laughter can be, pretty healing in and of itself. And so I don't mind telling a joke, even if it is a corny joke and they're laughing at me as opposed to with me. And I'm okay with that, just so long as somebody's laughing. So it's a quick joke here. So a police officer pulls over a guy for speeding and he goes up to him and says, can I see your license? The driver says, I don't have one. It was revoked when I got my fifth DUI. And the officer says, well, okay, well, can I see the registration? And he goes, well, it's not my car. I stole it. And the officer's like, his car stolen? He goes, yeah, that's right. And come to think of it, I did see the registration in the glove box when I was putting the gun in there. And the officer's like, there's a gun in the glove box. And he goes, yeah, there's a gun in there because I put it there after I shot and killed the woman who owns the car and stuffed her body in the trunk. The officer's like, there's a body in the trunk? Driver's like, yep, there's a body there. And so after hearing all of this, the officer calls for backup. And the car is surrounded by police officers, and the captain comes out, and he's approaching the driver to handle this situation, and the captain goes, "All right, sir, can I see your license?" And the driver goes, "Yep, no problem. Here it is." And the captain's like, "Okay, can I see the registration?" And so he hands it to him, and he sees that the car is registered to the driver. He said, "Can you open up your glove box so you can see if there's a gun in there?" And there's no gun. The captain goes, "Can you open up your trunk? I was told that you said that there was a body in there." And the driver goes, "Oh yeah, sure, no problem." So he opens up the trunk, no body. And the captain's like, "I don't understand. The officer who stopped you said you told him that you didn't have a license, you stole the car, you had a gun in the glove box, there's a body in the trunk." And the driver goes, "Yeah, and I bet that lying bastard told you I was speeding too."
That's perfect. Perception is everything.
That is a good example of perception, right? Thank you for indulging me in that bad joke. But thank you for taking the time to join us and sharing your information, your background, that hopefully can help some folks out if they are dealing with secondary trauma, addiction, and that they can get the support that they need through your work, or at least it can maybe put a name to the problem and could help lead them in the right direction. So I do really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing all of this with us.
Well, thank you for allowing me to be here. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to support the show, please check out Scott's book, Surviving Son, on Amazon. All of the sales from that book go directly back into this podcast and work to help veterans in need. You can also follow the Drive On Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, and wherever you listen to podcasts.